This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Welcome to Health and Living with me, Ti Xiao Yik. International Women's Day is celebrated annually on the 8th of March, and in conjunction with this, we want to highlight several women's health issues that don't always get the attention they need. And today is one of those. We'll be discussing a rare disorder that affects women, and it's called Meyer-Rokitansky-Kusterhauser syndrome, or MRKH syndrome for short. This is a condition that specifically affects a woman's reproductive system, where the uterus is not developed or is underdeveloped. And I find this really interesting because we know so little about the many rare diseases out there, and this is just one of many that I think it's important for people to be aware about and to know how it affects girls and women. So on the show today, to shed more light on this rare condition, as well as to talk about the challenges in terms of access to medical care, getting the support and understanding that they need from society, joining me are Dr. Hariza Hatim from the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology from Hospital Chancellor Tuanku Muhriez, as well as Wani Ardi, the founder of MRKH Malaysia, which is a patient support group. How are the both of you today?
I'm good. I'm good. Thank you.
Yes, I'm fine. Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you so much for your time to talk to us more about this. So did I pronounce it correctly?
I usually get it wrong as well. It's a mouthful, so, yeah.
So we will say MRKH, shall
yes.
we?
Shall.
Dr. Hariza, perhaps I can get you to help us understand what exactly is MRKH syndrome?
Well, it's essentially when a girl is born without a uterus. She does not only have no uterus, but sometimes she do have a rudimentary uterus, but it's non-functioning. And she won't have a cervix, as well as she won't have the upper part of the vagina. So she will have a short vagina. However, she would have normal functioning ovaries, meaning that she would have a normal secondary sexual characteristics. The breast development is normal. She would have a pubic and axillary hair. And if you do get a blood test to see if she's XY or XX, she's an XX genetically. And this is to differentiate with other types of syndromes where a girl is born without a uterus.
So because the ovaries are functioning as they typically would, is the hormonal cycle functioning fully normally as well? Is menstruation present, for instance?
Well, yes, she would have her normal hormonal cyclical, yes. But she would not have her menses because essentially she does not have the uterus. So our menses come from the endometrium lining of the uterus. And the hormone present in our body is the one that causes the uterine lining to proliferate, and then at the end of the cycle it sheds out as her period. But because she doesn't have a uterus, she won't have that, but the hormonal cycle is still there. Some of the girls do still have cyclical pains, so that's the difference between other conditions. Yeah.
Okay. And I understand, Dr. Hariza, that there are two types when it comes to MRKH. Could you explain what are the differences between these two types?
Yeah. So there's type 1 and type 2. And type 1 is just when she does not have a uterus, a cervix, and the upper part of the vagina. But type 2 is when it's associated with other kind of abnormalities, for example, kidney abnormalities, spine problems, you have hearing problems. Sometimes they would have additional digits. So it's basically a whole entire syndrome that she would have.
I see. So what exactly causes MRKH to develop in a person?
Well, there's no known cause. It's usually sporadic, but there are certain instances where it's reported to be inherited. With certain mutated genes, but generally we don't know what's the cause. Yes.
I see. Wani, can I get you to jump in now and share your story with us? So you've been diagnosed with MRKH. Can you share what that journey has been like? From what made you see the doctor to get this diagnosis?
Okay. Of course, it was. It has been a really long journey. But I'm going to focus on the moment that I was diagnosed. I was diagnosed at the age about 17 to 18 years old. I was not getting my period, as opposed to my sister who got hers pretty early. I sort of gave myself a time limit, like, until when am I going to wait for my period to arrive? I gave myself a limit, and it was SPM. So I finished my SPM. I still haven't gotten my period. So that was when my mother brought me to the clinic. But maybe because it's such a rare syndrome, so many doctors are not familiar with it. I was basically being passed from one doctor to another, and none of them mentioned MRKH. The last doctor just told us that they couldn't detect my uterus. They didn't mention about me not having my upper vagina. I guess it's a sensitive issue, and I was very young. The only thing that they told us was that when I'm much older and when I'm planning to settle down, please come back to us. So for me, as a 17-year-old, as an 18-year-old, it was very confusing because I was not getting much information from the doctors apart from they could not detect my uterus. I was like, what does that even mean, you know? And it was a condition that I've never heard of. So I could not relate to that. And I couldn't find anyone within my circle, my friends or my cousins, who has this condition. I don't know anyone without uterus. I don't know anyone without period. So I felt very isolated. I felt different. And being a teenager, feeling different is the last thing that you ever wanted, you know? Like us as adults, maybe we value uniqueness and being different more, but as a teenager, all I wanted was to fit in. I didn't want to be different. I didn't want to feel different. So having this diagnosis, it totally removed me from the normalcy that I've known all my life. The normalcy as in, you know, girls should have period, women should be able to get pregnant. And I think it hit me differently compared to how it hit my mother. It was a big hit for both of us, but my mother, being the adult in the conversation, she was concerned, she was worried about my future, like, will I ever settle down? Will I have a happy marriage? Will I face rejection? Will I ever have my own kids? And me being a child myself, essentially, at that age, of course, I thought about, you know, marriage and my future and having my own family and all that. But I didn't have much concern on that as opposed to, you know, just wanting to be a normal teenager. And it made me push myself to mature beyond my age, because at that age, girls would usually worry about, you know, exams and about that boy that they like, about popularity in school, about sports, about academic. But I had to worry about not having my own child, not having anyone wanting to marry me. So yeah, in terms of how do I deal with my diagnosis, It was a very isolated feeling, yes.
But how did you, get support, or how did you deal with it? Because it's so much for a 17, 18-year-old to come to terms with. No girl, no young girl should be expected to have to, cope with this on her own. So, what was it in your life that helped you to cope, and what came next for you?
I sort of stayed in denial for a few years, the first few years, just trying not to think about it, because, you would be scared of the things that you don't know. So me having all this fear, I decided to just ignore it and pretend that it didn't exist. It was not until my early 20s that I decided, time's up. I need to face this. I cannot pretend that it doesn't exist. I educate myself by reading up a lot on MRK syndrome. This was when the World Wide Web is, on the rise, and everybody's using the internet and Google is everything. I didn't have that as a teenager. So as someone in early 20s, with all the information on my fingertips, I used that opportunity to study what is this condition. That was when I actually found out that the name is MRK, not from doctors, but from my own reading. And that was also when I found out that there are support groups in other countries, mainly in US. So I became a member in the Beautiful You Foundation MRK support group in US. And that was when I realized that peer support is so important. Like, I could always go to my friends, to my mother, but it will not be the same as having people in the same shoes, on the same boat as you, supporting you and telling you that, I know what you're going through, So the first moment that I had a Skype session with the founder of Beautiful You Foundation, the co-founder, who is Christina Ruth Martin. So that was the very first time that I laid my eyes on an MRKH person. And it was so empowering. I was like, oh my God, like, this person has the same condition as me, and the things that we got to talk about, the experiences that we share, it was so empowering that I wanted that same experience for MRK Malaysian women. I was like, I want this in Malaysia. I want this kind of support group in Malaysia. I think Malaysia deserves this. Of course, I'm getting all this amazing support from my MRK sisters in US, in UK, Canada. But it wouldn't be the same as Malaysians, sharing the same culture and background and upbringing. So that's how initially I got my support from the support group in the US. Yes.
Dr. Hariza, any story must be quite typical among women in Malaysia who eventually get the diagnosis, right? Do we know how common is MRKH in Malaysia, but how much of it goes undiagnosed as well?
Well, worldwide, we know that it is 1 in 5,000, but we don't really have in number here in Malaysia. But in the pediatric adolescent guiding clinic, we do find one new case every at least 2 weeks. And I think partly it's because of Wani being vocal about it, sharing it on social media. And that not only makes a realization from the community, creates awareness by the community as well as the healthcare practitioners. So a lot of the time, they would refer more and more cases to the PAG unit. So we don't just see MRKH, but other form of disorder of sexual development in PAG or adolescent patients. Yeah, so we don't really have a specific number for that.
Let's take a quick break now. I'm speaking to Dr. Hariza Hatim from the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology from Hospital Chancellor Tuanku Muris and Wani Ardi, the founder of MRKH Malaysia, a patient support group, about MRKH syndrome. Just as a refresher, MRKH syndrome affects women's reproductive systems, resulting in the uterus being absent or underdeveloped, as well as women having an underdeveloped vagina. So we'll be right back after a few messages. Stay tuned to BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Health and Living on the Bigger Picture with me, T. Shalik. On the line with me today are Dr. Hariza Hatim. She's from the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology at Hospital Chancellor Tuanku Muris, and also Wani Ardi, who's the founder of MRKH Malaysia. We've been talking about MRKH syndrome, and before the break, Dr. Hariza explained what MRKH is and how it affects a woman's reproductive system. We've also heard from Wani, who shared what her journey has been like since she was diagnosed and how she found support from other MRKH women through a support group in the United States. I want to come back to the point that Wani made earlier about how among the doctors that she saw when she was trying to get a diagnosis, they told her to only come back when you're ready to start a family. Now, that's pretty alarming to me because it seems to send a message that you're not empowered to do anything about your life and, you know, when you live with this condition. What do you think, Dr. Hariza?
Well, that's true. A lot of the time, the doctors would say, because essentially MRKH, the two main problems that they would have is sexual relations and as well as fertility problems. So when we do get cases diagnosed at, say, at the age of 17, being in our culture, being in Muslim culture or an Asian culture per se, we don't really talk about sex. It's basically a taboo. So we usually would say, okay, so since you're not, most likely you're not going to have sex now at 17 years old, we want to see you later on when you're about to get married. And then we will talk about what we're going to do or how we're going to help you in you know, going through the marriage per se. So it's still pretty much a taboo. And I think this kind of mentality should be changed, and we should talk and be frank to the patient what are the problems that they might have later on, especially when they are sexually active and about to embark in their marriage. I think, like Wani have just mentioned just now, the term MRKH is really, really important. Just by saying, no, you don't have a uterus, you can't have your periods, that is not essentially what they want to know, because there's many other conditions where a woman does not have a uterus and a woman does not have her menses. So having the term MRKH allows her to do her own research and find out more about MRKH by herself, you know. You know, just put up MRKH online and she will be able to get bounce of information, especially, you know, now that we have the MRKH Malaysia support group. Yeah.
Wani, when you talk to other women, you know, through MRKH Malaysia, and you provide that peer support to each other, how do you address this aspect that Dr. Hariza just talked about the taboos when it comes to talking about sex and the reproductive health? How do you address this very sensitive topic that I think is about a girl's identity, a girl and a woman's identity, and just helping them to come to terms with accepting how this fits into their life.
Yeah. The response that I got from MRKH Malaysia members, they're mostly positive, though, of course, it varies according to the individual themselves and what stage of acceptance are they at, because some members they prefer to have private communication, just one-on-one between them and me. And some of them are comfortable being in a group discussion with all other members. But there are also some who prefer to be anonymous or invisible, like a silent member. Like, they don't want to be included in the group, in the private group that we have on Facebook. They're also not comfortable to be in the group that we have on WhatsApp, but they want that connection with me and other MRK sisters who are providing ears, and you know, because we have this we kind of have this program called Sister to Sister, where we have a list of MRK sisters who volunteered themselves, and they are located at different places, different cities, different states. So if any member wish to see an MRK sister, you know, for comfort, for more guidance, or if they want to bring their partner or their family member to this MRK sister, so that maybe this MRK sister could explain better. So they are free to do that. In terms of talking about, you know, intimate stuff, like the one that Dr. Hariza mentioned, they prefer to do that on one-on-one session like this, like face-to-face. And it is something that they're not able to talk about with their partner, because some partners are supportive, but some are not really. But mostly because they don't truly understand the condition. So it always takes a third party to explain the details. Yes, but most of them are open to discussing it, but privately.
Mm. Yeah. Dr. Hariza, presumably because many young girls or young women are diagnosed, like you said, around the age of the late adolescence age, so a pediatric and adolescent gynecologist like yourself would see them first. But as they grow into adulthood, which specialist does their care come under?
Well, they do still go under the pediatric adolescent gynecology, even though they're in their 20s or late 30s, because essentially the PAG team or the PAG specialist or consultants would have the know-hows to, for example, if they require a surgery, they would essentially see a PAG consultant, yes.
Okay. All right. Since you've mentioned surgery, can we talk a little bit about what are some options when it comes to managing MRKH?
Right. So in MRKH, I think the two main aspects of the problems that they face is, number one is sexual intimacy because of the short vagina. So in that, we would, first of all, the first line would be vaginal dilatation. And of course, this would usually be recommended if the girl is planning to get married, usually 6 months before the marriage, or if they are sexually active previously, they would want to try vaginal dilatation earlier. Of course, it's not... it's not easy, it's not comfortable, and sometimes if it takes a lot of effort for them to do it by themselves, because one session to teach them dilatation is not, it's not enough. So sometimes in PPUKM, we would admit them, we would do an intensive vaginal dilatation program where we would admit them to the ward, for at least 3 days, teach them how to do the vaginal dilatation, and do it intensively for at least about 3 to 5 times a day for several minutes to hours, 30 minutes and so on. So this usually creates, number one, creates a depth in the vagina quite a significant depth in the vagina. And then later on, it also creates confidence for them to do it by themselves when they go back home. So, and then later on, they would need to continue the dilatation. Sometimes certain women do want to do surgery. This is called a vaginoplasty. There's several different types of vaginoplasty surgeries. But at the end of the end of the day, they would still need to do a vaginal dilatation to keep the vagina patent, right? So second of all, the second problem would be fertility. They are unable to conceive, but they do have functioning ovaries. So in areas, in places such as in Europe, in the UK or the US, they do have surrogacy. So we could do an in vitro fertilization and have a surrogate mother. But however, in Malaysia and even in Asia, surrogacy is still illegal. And as a Muslim, a lot of them, it's still illegal by the Sharia law as well. So the only option for the girls at the moment is adoption.
I see. All right. Wani, things, procedures like vaginal dilatation, vaginoplasty surgery, all of that must require a lot of support for the girls, yes, and the women, I guess, when they hear about, yes, these options. How does MRKH help them through to, you know, understand all of these?
MRKH Malaysia is very lucky and very blessed because we have, for example, the PPUKM as our official partners. We also have the MRDS, Malaysian Rare Disorder Society. We have the Global MRKH. We have the Beautiful You Foundation. We have AWAS, Awareness on Suicide Malaysia. So we have all these partners who are supporting us, so it doesn't feel like we're merely supporting ourselves. And like you said, that process of dilating and vaginoplasty, all that requires tremendous support from all sides. And this is where peer support comes in, because this is definitely not something that just anyone would understand. You know, your family wouldn't be able to understand, your close friends wouldn't be able to understand, only MRKH women would understand, and of course, the doctors who are treating us. And in my own personal experience, I didn't have any idea at all that I didn't have my upper vagina. It was short. I only found out upon checking it myself, because during that time, I was supported by the support group in US, and they taught me how to use the dilator, how to do the dilatation. So I checked it myself, and I found out that yes, my vagina was very short. I did it myself, but I would say that I couldn't have done it without the support from that support group. So since then, you know, I've always wanted to give that same support to MRKH Malaysian women. Yes.
Dr. Hariza, what if a woman doesn't want to opt for those procedures?
The vaginal dilatation or the surgery, per se?
Either of them, yeah.
Okay. Well, they might, depends on the severity of the shortness of the vagina. Sometimes we do have patients who have, I guess, physiological dilatation when they are sexually active. But there are certain instances or certain cases where the lady have very traumatic sexual intercourse, and it causes up until, you know, injury to their perineum and such. So it is still an essential part of the treatment of MRKH, especially if she wants to be sexually active. But if that's not her choice and she's not sexually active, it's definitely her option or her choice. Yes. Again, it's a very taboo subject to talk about, not us being Asian is, you know, something that we rarely talk frankly to them with. So it's something that you need to slowly instill with them in, and the support group really helps.
Will the dilatation and or the surgery result in fairly normal sexual intercourse?
Yes, a lot of people have undergone even just vaginal dilatation and then come back and said that, you know, they would have, you know, healthy sexual.
Yeah. Mm, okay. But I'm thinking about what you said about traumatic and probably very painful early sexual experiences. How common is that, especially if there are women who perhaps never have a chance to get this diagnosed and don't know really what their condition is?
Well, to be honest, I've only met one case where she had a very traumatic, because she did not know her condition. She was in a marriage and she had a terrible sexual episodes, and then that led to requiring multiple surgeries because of the perineal tear and perineal trauma. And then because of that, that's when she found out that she had MRKH. So whether it is it common or not, I don't really have the numbers, but we've met one or two cases that's had.
What about from your experience, Wani, through the support group?
It's fairly common actually, because from time to time I would have MRKH Malaysia members who would come to me personally and share with me their personal problems. So in terms of unpleasant sexual experiences, that's quite common, especially if they didn't have the opportunity to do dilatation before marriage. It all comes down to, in the end, the partner. Do they have a supportive partner or someone who is not very supportive? Supportive partners, usually, they're patient. Like, once we've explained to the partner that, you know, this is the condition of your wife, through time, through practice, it'll get better and better, and your sexual experience will be will improve from now. But of course, there are also partners who are not very supportive and resort to divorce a week or even a month after marriage, because, you know, they don't have the patience to practice and to go through the stages of dilatation. Yes. So it's fairly common.
If we look at the bigger picture, Dr. Haiza, what is the journey of that treatment? How long would that typically take? And what's the outlook? What's the outlook for a woman living with MRKH?
When I was talking to some of the patients with MRKH, I think a lot of them mainly has a lot of emotional issues just to merely accept the condition, because with vaginal dilatation and we have adoption processes, that are the things that, you know, we can dealt with. But emotional and being able to actually accept their condition, feeling less of a woman, being inferior to others, you know, feeling that they are unable to probably get married, or once they do get married, they are unable to bear children, they're unable to satisfy their husband. Those are the things that keeps on ruminating among a lot of this, a lot of the women that we see. So in the end of the day, I think the most important part of treatment for MRKH is a psychological treatment. Identify whether they have the need to be referred to a psychologist or a psychiatrist, and then later on we slowly instill to them what are the things that they need to do, whether it be vaginal dilatation, whether it be, you know, the through going through the adoption process. We try slowly to bring in what we call as a uterine transplant, but it is a long way to go. There has been several uterine transplant done in the world, maybe around 11 different. The first would be in Saudi Arabia, and then the first successful one is in Sweden. So it has been done, but it takes a long process to go through it. And it's not something that we, you know, we would say, okay, let's look forward for it. You know, for one particular for one particular patient, no. It is something in the future, yes, but it will make it. The process is long. It's difficult. It's not easy even for the patient themselves. The surgery is long, and she would need to be immunosuppressed, and she will probably have a lot of complications during the pregnancy, and so on and so forth. So at this point of time, I think the most important thing with dealing with MRKH is, number one, is to create awareness among the community about why is it essential to bring your girls early for follow-up if she does not have her periods. Make sure that we are able to investigate and exclude things like MRKH and other causes of amenorrhea. And then slowly tell her what's the problem, talk to her, give her support. The parents are the most important person to give the support. And if they're married, you know, they need an understanding husband, understanding partner, and the family, including the family and the in-laws. Yeah, and essentially, you know, just creating awareness, not just the community, but also the healthcare personnel.
Yes, the healthcare personnel. But actually, before I do want to talk to you, Dr. Hariza, about level of awareness among, say, primary care and other physicians. But Wani, I'm just curious to find out, are you pinning your hopes on something like uterine transplant, or are you more in favor of just, okay, let's deal with what's here and now?
Of course, I hope for uterine transplant to happen. But like Dr. Hariza said, I am aware that it's not going to happen in the near future. But I'm hoping for it to be a reality maybe in 10 years' time. So whatever that we're working together now, it's for the younger MRKH girls. So probably the teenage MRKH girls would benefit from it, hopefully. As for my generation of MRKH women, I personally, of course, have singled out the hope for uterine transplant, because I know it's not for me. But it's okay, because we have another option, which is adoption. Even though it's an idea that maybe not everybody would be able to embrace, but it's definitely an option for us to be mothers. And I think that's the biggest challenge of all, which is to reset our minds from what we deem as normal. Like, for us, MRKH women, our biggest challenge, of course, you know, building relationship, educating our loved ones, like when it's too early to tell, when it's too late to tell our boyfriend, for example, building our own self-esteem, our own self-worth. But the biggest challenge of all is to reset our mind. Motherhood is not necessarily pregnancy or childbirth, you know. Adopting also make you mothers, and not any less of a mother. and also to redefine family. Let's say you prefer to be childless, you prefer to be without a child, just you and your husband. That is also a family, just you and your husband. That is also a family. And this is not the usual idea of family that, you know, we Asians would have, but we have to reset our minds, or else our concept of happiness, our definition of happiness would be so rigid, you know. And also, we have to redefine sexual and intimacy. Sexual and intimacy between partners doesn't necessarily mean sexual intercourse. You know, there's, I mean, if we were to talk about sex, it's a long winding road. There's mm-hmm. a whole lot to be discussed about. There's many ways for you to make your partners happy, for your partner to make you happy. So, yeah, it's really about redefinition. Redefinition is the biggest challenge for us Asians who are so accustomed to our own mindset.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I couldn't have said that better myself, Wani. But another big challenge, Dr. Hariza, I'm sure, is just the level of education and awareness among the medical fraternity about MRKH. And especially when young girls, young women probably come into contact with the GPs first or with other pediatricians or other doctors. So I know you've done a study in PPUKM. Are there any insights from your study that would help to, you know, for us to understand how to better educate the medical fraternity?
Well, I think... yes, a lot of the girls that I've talked to with MRKH, they went to multiple different GPs, keep on retelling their stories, and then eventually getting frustrated. And some of them were even given unnecessary hormonal treatment. So I think the most important part is creating awareness, starting off from the undergrad. Because I remember when I was in medical school, we were just, you know, it was just something that we flipped through. It's not something that we really studied. But being, creating awareness among the medical students, and then later on the medical officers, the GPs, the pediatricians, and even the gynecologists, some of them, you know, rarely have seen a case of MRKH. I think that's really important. And then now that the PAG unit in PPUKM is sort of establishing themselves, slowly expanding the number of doctors that are qualified as a PAG specialist, we have several referral centres now. In PPKM, and then there's one in there's a specialist in Ampang as well as in Lika Sabah. So if we hope that we can expand it even further, so in each and every state there will be a specialist specifically for PAG, so that, you know, not only GPs but other specialists can consult with. So yeah.
All right, great. Unfortunately, we are running out of time, but can I get a final message from each of you on what we've been discussing today, Dr. Hariza?
I think it's really important that the community, parents, the schools even, teachers, and also the healthcare practitioners are able to see what are the things that are bothering our adolescent, especially girls, in terms of having their menses, reaching menarche, and being able to detect that there is something wrong at the age of 16, when they don't have their menses, they should be referred to a gynecologist so that we can investigate and exclude other different causes of primary amenorrhea. It might just be physiological, she might just be late, but it's good that we are aware that there could be some abnormalities that she might have. So it's good that we're able to detect it early, so that, you know, psychologically she'll be prepared, and the parents are aware of the condition and can help her through it. Another thing is that we have to be more vocal in terms of talking about sexual health and sexual education among our teenagers. You know, it should not be something taboo. We should change our, like Mwani said, we should change our cultural norm. We should be able to, girls should be able to express their concern in terms of sex, in terms of your periods, and not be too malu about it. So that's our culture. We are always malu, we are always segan. And that's not just within the Malays, but even within the Chinese and the Indians, because when I was doing my study, I only had a lot of Malay participants, I think mainly because Wani was vocal and they followed Wani. But if probably I had somebody who is as vocal as Wani, who is maybe Chinese or Indian, probably I will have more participants from other culture, and that will make the study, that will be, you know, more helpful for us healthcare practitioners, you know, to know what are the things that they need, you know, and they want us to, you know, inform them. Yeah,
we need more champions like Wani. Can we get a final message from you, Wani?
I think Dr. Harissa have said everything. I would stress on early diagnosis as well. That is so important. And also, I would stress on sticking to your pace, because every MRKH woman is different. Different types of MRKH, you know, have different challenges. Different stage of life would have different challenges as well. So stick to your pace. You don't have to conform to, you know, what the society deem as normal. And yesterday I was listening to this TED talk by a speaker who has MRKH syndrome, and there's something that she said that really inspired me. She said, happiness is not only about focusing on what we have, but happiness is also about what we don't have and what we do with it. So it's very important to, you know, focus on what we have instead of what we don't have, and to focus on the things that we can control instead of the things that we cannot control. So in terms of things that we can control, you can go for early diagnosis. You can face your fears, and we are here to help you. You are not at all alone. You are one in 5,000, but you are not alone.
Yes. And if people want to know more about MRKH Malaysia and reach out to you, how can they find you?
We are on Facebook, MRKH Malaysia, and we are also on Instagram. So for anyone to be a member, they can approach us there. All we need is their medical report or letters from doctor just to verify that they are indeed, you know, MRKH patient, and we would include them in their sisterhood.
All right. Thank you so much to the both of you for speaking to me today. I've been speaking to Dr. Hariza Hatim from the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology from Hospital Chancellor Tuanku Morris, and also Wani RD, the founder of MRKH Malaysia, a patient support group. And we've been discussing Meyer-Rokitansky-Kusterhauser syndrome, or MRKH syndrome, as part of an ongoing series this month to highlight women's health issues in conjunction with International Women's Day. You've been listening to Health and Living on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.